Good afternoon and welcome. You're listening to WPKN at 89.5 FM, streaming live at WPKN.org. The name of the show is In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. We'll be giving out our telephone number shortly. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe. I'm here with my fellow host Gus Candavero.
Hello, everybody.
And also joining us is our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott-Rowe.
Afternoon.
I just want to remind listeners that we are on, In Context is on every Monday at noon for 1 hour, except the first Monday of the month. And you can find us at on the internet at incontextreport.com. That's incontextreport.com, where we post archives of our shows and our blog comments, and you can also reach us an email that way. And if you want to reach us an email during the show, you can send an email to Ken at mdrtalk.org. We always love to hear your comments, and if you have a comment or a question, we'll read it on the air. That's Ken at mdrtalk.org. And I also like to mention that coming up in 2 weeks, we have a fascinating show on psychiatric drugs with Dr. Peter Bregan. He's the country's leading authority on psychiatric drugs. He's written his latest book is called Medication Madness, and he's asking the question, are psychiatric drugs that we are taken by tens of a million Americans for conditions like depression and ADHD, are they actually doing more harm than good? So you want to listen to that show on in 2 weeks on Monday, March the 12th at noon with Dr. Peter Bregan. Today being our the last Monday of the month, we have our special monthly war report with Marchand, and we're going to look at the latest developments in the global wars and try to get behind these developments to see what the geopolitical strategy of the various players are. And I'd like to start with Syria, which has been in the news for over several months now. Things are getting hotter in Syria. And the question I'd like to start off with, Marchand, is our media accurately portraying the uprising in Syria as sort of an indigenous democratic movement being suppressed by the Assad government? Or are we watching the great powers, East and West, play out some sort of a drama in the context of Syria?
Well, I think certainly. I highly doubt that this is – it may have started out as an indigenous uprising. You know, people – part of the Arab Spring, people wanted democracy. People wanted regime change. But I'm inclined not to believe that the Syrian people are out there on the streets slaughtering, you know, their own soldiers and their own people. I mean, that's been the great question amongst, you know, the American military, was that if we did, for whatever reason, you swear allegiance to the Constitution, develop a totalitarian state, would you get out there and shoot Americans? And then fundamentally, would Americans go out and kill other American soldiers? Just the level of barbarism on the part of the so-called rebels does lead me to really question the validity and the fact that they use the same tactics as al-Qaeda, the tactics of suicide bombing, random killings of innocent civilians. And, you know, by the way, this is the rebels I'm talking about, not the government.
Right.
So it seems to me like these are outside forces. Almost like a good comparison would be the French Revolution. I believe you were telling me about that not that long ago, when so-called foreigners from Marseille, was it?
Yeah, I think it was called the September Massacres. I think it was 17, maybe 1790. It was
a catchy title.
It destabilized the French Revolution. And I personally suspect that these terrorists were brought into Paris. They killed killed a tremendous number of priests, terrorized the population, and generally created a horrible atmosphere in the city, which eventually led to the Reign of Terror. And I personally think that it was probably agents. They were agents of either the Austrians or the English who were infiltrating the country to destabilize the French Revolution.
Which, the oldest trick in the book,
really. Oldest trick in the world, because the last thing that the monarchies of England and Austria wanted was a stable constitutional monarchy and a strong France. And by turning the revolution upside down and moving it into a radical phase, France became a basket case.
It's an old trick we've used before, and that's been used in history. And this is just to give you a historical example. And from our own history, we have the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, which is the reason why we supposedly have the guys who have the nukes now, or want the nukes, or we're accusing them of having the nukes. Supposedly the reason why they're in power is because we toppled the democratic leader, Mohammad Mossadegh. And we used these same tactics. We sent in goons who went in and blew stuff up and shot people and blew up mosques. And then they threw pamphlets saying, up with communism, down with Allah, down with Mozadek. And, you know, this is all open source. The CIA has acknowledged it.
Exactly. We're not just speculating. In the New York Times, just a week ago, our own government admitted or said that they believed that Al-Qaeda was behind many of the recent terrorist acts, including the Aleppo bombing that killed so many people just recently. And they feel that the Al-Qaeda, probably from Iraq, is now operating in there. Whether they're doing with our approval or not as part of some destabilization program, of course, our government would admit that. But the fact that we acknowledged Al-Qaeda is there. And also Debka, the important Israeli national security newsletter, published a couple weeks ago that Qatar was flying Al-Qaeda fighters from Libya to the border of Syria, presumably for insertion and to aid in the uprising against the Assad government. And, of course, we now know that Al-Qaeda was very much allied with the NATO and the United States in overthrowing Gaddafi.
Well, and also, you know, as another point, too, Debka is an Israeli intelligence newsletter. So, you know, this is far from being pro-Assad and pro-Iranian. But the thing that I think is really interesting is Debka also reported that the United States shipped thousands of troops that were bound to go home from Iraq. They were scheduled to go home. They were on the planes to go home, and they were dropped. They were landed in Jordan and deployed to the Syrian border. And I'm sure these guys are doing more than just sitting around, you know, staring at the sand. I mean, there's more likely than not, this is a combat support role. They're providing some sort of, whether it's intelligence or material aid or personnel aid, as a launching point for special forces
and
CIA
operatives. There are reports that what British special forces and Qatari special forces are on the ground in Syria.
Yes.
Directing logistical support, I guess, helping them to target government forces.
Exactly. And the Russians have struck back, you know, with their own response. I mean, we're really pushing ourselves towards an open confrontation with Russia, because Russia's decided, you know, you've pushed us far enough, and they've promised openly in RIA Novosti, which is a Russian intelligence newsletter, that they are giving Assad not just intelligence, but GPS tracking systems using the satellites, or GPS imagery, I'm sorry, satellite imagery to demonstrate, to show the Syrian intelligence agents where the rebels are, where their strongholds are. It's basically, what it does is it takes a satellite photograph in real time, mm-hmm. or video, I should say, in real time, of the battlefield or of a specific city or region. And this way, then the Syrians, instead of walking blindly down a street taking fire or having to shell a whole block to get one sniper, now they know this is where the rebels are headquartered out of. This is where their arms depot is. This is where they're organizing from. This is where they're gathering forces so they can strike and then hit the stronghold.
So given that information, it kind of seems contradictory or silly to say what our American mainstream media has been reporting, to say that he's indiscriminately killing his own civilians, you know, just randomly driving down the streets and opening fire on groups of
in
people.
In fact, they say, the talking heads and the networks say repeatedly that the government of Syria is murdering scads
outrightly,
of its own. Murdering, slaughtering. How long can we let it go on? And we've seen this before in other situations, particularly in Libya, as a precursor to American military.
Right, but when in reality, it would appear, because, I mean, people always put information into boxes because it's easier for them to process, you know, and it's easier to make characterizations about people, right? So we don't even have to think twice or think about human motivation to think that, okay, Assad's a bad guy, like a cartoon criminal mafia character, and he's driving down the street doing drive-by shootings, killing women and children as they shop for loaves of bread.
Sure.
But that's just easier for us we don't have to think about that, right?
No.
But in reality, you got to think about this. It's complex. You have rebels who are armed by outside influences. They are taking up hostages, basically, by staying inside civilian centers, population centers. They're using civilians as body shields, basically. And then the Assad government and the military is going into those locations, trying to kill the rebels, and civilians are getting caught in the crossfire. And this is an unfortunate truth, but that's what it is. That's what's happening.
That was described by Webster Tarpley, the important...
Tarpley went further. Tarpley said that they were actually rooftop snipers, which were rebels, and they were shooting civilians in order to make it look like the government was shooting them.
That's right. And he said that based upon his visit there last November.
Right. Right, right.
And it's you hit it right on the head. And it's completely contradictory to human logic that the Syrians would just be going through wiping out their own people.
Why? Why would they risk an uprising, a popular revolution? That's stupid.
Exactly. And the fact is, you know, people who say, well, you know, Assad is shelling these villages. Well, in the first place, if you watch CNN and the BBC and all of those other mainstream outlets, they always say this cannot be confirmed because nobody's there. They're right. getting a press release from the Syrian National Council. But the fact is, and this is something that
they do have supposed journalists who have snuck across the border and, you know, they're embedded there and they can't give up their location. They have to shoot their reports from inside their stone hut at night so that it doesn't look like where you can identify where they are. But they may not even be there. How can you take a word with someone who can't confirm where they are?
The first thing I've learned is never, ever trust what the government tells you outright. Always ask for proof.
Mm. Well, you know, we could put this in context. It's the name of the show. If we look at the last 10 years of American policy in Syria, you start with 2001, the memo that General Clark, Wesley Clark, talked about with a long list of Middle Eastern nations we were going to conquer that he saw in the Pentagon shortly after 9/11, and Syria was on that list. And then you move forward to 2005, and George Bush Jr. Authorized money to fund Syrian opposition groups, again, to destabilize the Assad regime. And then in January of 2011, the U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford arrived there, and Ford was a protege of John Negroponte, who is widely believed to have organized the death squads in Central America and was ambassador to Iraq during some of the worst sectarian violence there. Ford immediately meets with Syrian opposition groups to the disdain of the populace. If you remember, the populace was besieging him when he was going to these meetings because they knew what he was up to. Mm-hmm. And a couple months after Ford arrives, demonstrations start happening. And then we find that in August of that year, 2011, Debka's reporting, again, Debka, the Israeli national, the Israeli security newsletter, is reporting that NATO is drawing up plans to arm Syrian people, Syrian resistance fighters. And then, of course, and late in 2011, we see the establishment of the so-called Syrian Free Army in a safe haven provided by Turkey right on the border there, and it's being funded and armed and trained. And now we know it's being partly manned by Al-Qaeda fighters that are being flown in by our surrogate, Qatar. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing has been developing for a long time. So when Hillary Clinton calls for the overthrow of the Syrian government, it's just not coming out of left field.
No.
This has been a campaign since 2001 to take over Syria.
Not even, but taking it further, people say, yeah, but we have to do this stuff. Now, I mean, you've heard of the Midas touch where everything you touch turns to gold. We have the opposite of touch. Everything we touch turns to char and ash. Everything. We get involved in the Egyptian uprising. Now they have a military dictatorship that's, instituting Sharia law. We get involved in Libya and Al-Qaeda takes it over. And now they have people running around decapitating black Africans because they were protected under the Gaddafi rule. Here in Syria, we're now helping and trying to arm Al-Qaeda and give them, strategical information to be able to take down this government. It just seems like everything we do is to stir up the hornet's nest and make it even worse. It's like instead of trying to put a cap in a volcano, we're trying to send, nuclear bombs down the top to try to get it to blow its top. It doesn't make any sense.
Why don't I just give out our phone number?
Oh, sure.
We'd like to hear what our listeners think. If you just tuned in, you're listening In Context on WPKN. WPKN's live public affairs call-in show, and we're talking with Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, about the global wars. And if you'd like to give us your thoughts on it, on Syria or any of the other hot areas that are involved in this war now, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Tell us what you think. If you'd rather email us, you can do so by writing us at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. Yes, Marshawn, go ahead.
I think the main point of, because I think one thing that Gus is very aptly pointing out is that what we're doing is creating chaos and instilling these dictatorships. Mm-hmm. But I think that's because the objective is not to bring democracy. Mm-hmm, or the objective is not to – we really don't care whether the Egyptians have a military dictatorship or the Libyans have a dictatorship.
Yeah, now you're getting to the point.
What they want is to keep the Russians and the Chinese out. That's the whole goal. It's about hegemony in the Middle East. And because after 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union, we were the hegemonic power. So we didn't need to necessarily topple the Syrian government. They were afraid of us. But now these countries have realized China's emerged has emerged into its own. Russia's emerged into its own. These have become major military powers. So the Syrians, the Iranians, the Libyans, all of these countries suddenly realize they don't need the U.S. for protection anymore. They get the Russians and the Chinese, and the Russians and the Chinese offer them a much more favorable deal than we will.
And, of course, the Russians and the Chinese have vetoed on the Security Council, or will veto, any effort by the U.S. to authorize a U.N. or NATO intervention in Syria. What's going on with the Russians? The Russians have a fleet. Do we have a phone call?
We have a call.
Oh, great.
Why don't you pick that up, and then we'll talk.
Okay.
Hello, caller?
No, he's not. No, he's got to pick it up first.
So we're going to take a look at what the Russians are doing too. They have a fleet in Tartus, so they have a pretty very substantial presence there. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're going to oppose at the UN any actions by us. And one of the things we need to talk about is this recent conference on the 24th in Tunis, mm-hmm. which Hillary Clinton was trying to orchestrate, I think, world support for military intervention, and things aren't going quite as smoothly as she planned. Mm. It looks like the next step is they're going to have to go to the UN and ask for some kind of a plan for a humanitarian relief. Do we have a caller now, Marshawn?
Yes, we do. Sorry, got to turn my mic back on. This is Mark. Hello,
welcome.
From Clinton.
Go ahead, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Hey, I'm listening to you guys on the radio, and I'm wondering to myself, what is this, colonization? Are we trying to colonize these guys? Are we taking them over? And this has been going over for a long time since... God, way before Vietnam, and mm-hmm. I just wonder, where are we leading to? Global domination?
It's a new kind of colonization, as opposed to having armies, let's say, and trying to create mini, like the Brits did in India or in Aden or countries like that, trying to create a mini Britain. What we want is it's a struggle for global hegemony. Just back to the days of the Cold War, like you said, before Vietnam, we were fighting the Soviets for control of regions, and we really didn't care. Like in Nicaragua, we didn't care whether the Contras really wanted to bring democracy. All we cared about is we would force the Soviets out. So it's expanding a empire through a spheres of influence.
And it's about financing the CIA, because the Contras were giving drugs to the CIA so that they could fly them in on protected planes, sell them here within the borders, laundering money, and self-financing itself.
Exactly.
Off budget.
But if you look at it, the broadest answer to Mark's question is that we saw in 1939 where we might be today. And that was epitomized in the War and Peace Study Report, which was commissioned by the Rockefellers. And William Engdahl talks about it in his book, A Century of War. Do we still have Mark on the line?
No, I think he hung up to take his call answer off the air.
And back then, in 1939, before the beginning of World War II, the large corporate interests, in partnership with the leading lights in the State Department, who really were the same people, mm-hmm. they drew up plans for the world after World War II. Mm-hmm. Now, this is 1939, even before Germany had invaded Poland. And they realized the British Empire was on its last legs. When it collapsed, we would emerge as the dominant power. And that's exactly what happened.
Right.
And since then, and of course, our only rival was the Soviet Union. We defeated them in the Cold War in 1990. And as soon as the sun set on the Soviet Empire, boom, we started our new campaign.
We took a new approach, though, something I think that even the Soviets didn't necessarily do. I think it was the approach we took was something very radical, in that we decided we didn't care whether they had a communist government or a democratic government or a dictatorship. The Soviets, when they invaded a country like they invaded Afghanistan, they wanted to install a communist Soviet-style regime, had to implement land reforms, give land to the peasants, et cetera, and whether this coincided with the indigenous culture or not was irrelevant. It was they had to bring them the light of communism, whereas we fundamentally don't want to do that. Our goal is to have a compliant government, regardless of their ideology. Yeah.
Well, it's the same. It's true on both sides, because the communists are not about individual rights or liberties or having comfort and property rights or anything like that. It's all about centralized power to the select few on the top of the government food chain, just like in our modern democracy here, and has been true throughout history with aristocracies and plutocracies and take your pick, oligarchies. It's all about select few people having centralized power at the top of the food chain. So if it's about getting Cuba from the Spaniards, it's about bananas and sugar crops. You know, it's all about getting favoritism.
But you always have to present to the folks at home a rationale which makes sense. So when we overthrew our Benz in Guatemala in 1954, we had to present to the American people he was a crazy communist, which of course he wasn't. The real reason for the war was because United Fruit Company was all upset because he was going to seize their land or confiscate it with compensation so he could redistribute it to the poor farmers. That was his sin, but we couldn't say that's the reason why we were overthrowing him. We had to say, well, he was a communist and a bad guy.
Yeah, the same thing was true with the Panamanian dictator when it came time to renegotiate the Panama Canal, you know, and he was a dictator. He was a general, but he wasn't a vicious, you know, tyrant as you see. He really was trying to, by force, protect the people from outside influences, just like Castro did. Castro was a student of history, and I'm not a fan of Castro, really, but he understood that unless you have that iron fist protecting your borders, outside influences come in and usurp your power.
You might say that we created Castro.
Well, and you see the same thing in Iran. You know, you had Mossadegh, who was democratically elected, who was not aligned. He didn't want the Soviet Union, but he didn't want the United States either.
Right.
Democratically elected. So we get rid of him. You know, we don't like him. He's not pro-American enough. We put in the Shah, who's an absolute tyrant. And then what's the backlash of that? We give the Shah Savak, which made the Gestapo look like the Boy Scouts. And then when the Shah's overthrown, what is the natural reaction of the Iranian people? They realize that if we don't have an authoritarian government, the Americans or somebody else, because it might not just be us, it might be the Brits or the French, are going to come in and topple our government. So you have this backlash. And again, certain presidents we had haven't helped that at all. I mean, when you had President Khatami in Iran, who was considered a moderate in terms of
internationally. When was he in power in relation to the revolution?
Well, he was in power in the late 90s through 2000 and whenever Ahmadinejad
was elected. So we kind of said with late Clinton, early George Bush Jr.
Mid-George Bush. Mm-hmm. But what had happened is Khatami said, you know, to the U.S., listen, we're never going to have Victoria's Secret, you know, stores with the half-naked models on the street. Yeah, just forget about it. But we do want to bring in the finer aspects of Western culture, Western music. We want to open relations.
McDonald's,
Burger King, Pizza Hut.
Didn't he also offer to help us in the war against the Taliban in Afghanistan?
He did. When we invaded Afghanistan, Khatami, because the Taliban were no friends of Iran, no friends of the Shia. They massacred the Shia in Afghanistan, and they actually killed the entire embassy staff, Iranian embassy staff in Kabul. So Khatami says, look, Bush, as a son of goodwill, I will give you intelligence. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the Quds Force, the same people we say we don't like, will help you. And that's what they did. They gave us intelligence, and they helped us with boots on the ground in Afghanistan. So then what does Bush do? Bush goes and gives you're part of the axis of evil. And Khatami says, whoa, listen, we're here we want to westernize. We want to open up. Mm-hmm. You know, we're still going to be an Islamic Republic, but we want to open up. And the immediate, again, backlash within the Bush administration was to say, no, this time when we invade Iraq, we don't want your help. We don't need your help. Because, again, Iran offered. They didn't like Saddam, and they said, we'll help you. And Bush says, no, you're the axis of evil. Well, okay, you're a terrorist. So then what happens? The backlash is now the elections come, and the Iranian people have seen. It's, you know, again, they vote the same as we do. But I think they put a little more thought into their candidates than we do. Mm-hmm. They said, look, Khatami, the reformer, as he's known, is he's failed. The West doesn't want us. Mm-hmm. The West has nothing but hostility.
So they turn inward.
Exactly. And they turn to a more authoritarian leader who they feel will protect them. Because it's kind of the philosophy of if you can't join them, beat them.
If you just join the program, you're listening to In Context. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus and Marshawn, and we're reviewing the global war situation and trying to make some geopolitical sense of it. To join the conversation, just give us a call on 203-336-9756. 203-336-9756, or you can drop us an email to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. We began the show talking about Syria. Now we've moved on to Iran. One of the things I'm wondering is, well, Iran is clearly an object of our desires. Iran is the country with the greatest oil and natural gas reserves combined in the entire world. All right. What is the relationship between our efforts to topple the Syrian government and our, it seems like, ever closer attack on Iran? Does one have to come before the other, Marshawn?
Well, I think there's a divide right now because the Israelis want to hit Iran. They want to hit Iran now. But I think one thing they're realizing is they wanted to topple Assad, and they thought toppling Assad would be a lot easier. They thought the Russians wouldn't get committed. The Russians have sent their elite SOBR, sober special forces, into Iran. I mean, I'm sorry, not Iran, Syria, along with their aircraft carrier, the Admiral Kuznetsov. So it turns out Syria's a lot harder to topple. So then the thought was, well, we'll just go bomb Iran. But Syria has a huge army. And as actually Debco reported today, Russia's upgraded its Syrian-based electronic warfare stations in electronic warfare stations within Syria. So if we go and attack Iran, we're not just going to have a Syrian army behind us, but we'll have a Russian army and a Syrian-backed Russian-backed Syrian force to our rear. So we'd be fighting fundamentally, and if you include Lebanon, we'd be fighting on three fronts. So,
and Iraq would join the fight, and you know, you would have a lot of people involved in this who aren't wearing uniforms. So this is an unwinnable conflict.
Exactly. So the idea is, what we're going to do is we would take on the Syrians first, defeat them, then isolate Lebanon so they couldn't get help from Iran, then take on Iran and hopefully intimidate Iraq.
And I think the contradiction involved here is who we pick to be the winners and who we pick to be the losers. Because, I mean, Saudi Arabia gets a complete pass in this entire situation when the whole flurry of wars was launched on the premise of 9/11, right? And we were attacked, so we have to go to where they are, right? But how many of the hijackers were Saudi Arabian, right? It was like three quarters of them, all but three or four.
It's amazing how successful our government is at putting over rationales for war which have nothing to do with the facts.
Yeah.
They just keep repeating them. People buy into them, and they're totally misleading. Like democracy, all of our strongest allies are these Emirates. Saudi Arabia is not a democracy. This is the opposite.
And we just never mention their names, yet the Saudi Arabians take advantage of the fact that there's a spike in oil prices by cutting production.
But these are the moderates.
These are our friends?
These are Arab League allies, and they're all basically authoritarian regimes.
And this basically just takes advantage of the fact that Americans just don't know anything.
Exactly. We have a call right now from Rick in Meriden. Rick, you're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Rick.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I was listening to your analysis, and I wanted to agree with a little bit of it. You know, when in a geopolitical sense of things, when this country, when the United States tries to, in quotations, export democracy, it's unfortunate that the people who do that try to impose this country's cultural values on whatever country they're aiming at. And you said that, you know, when the Iranian regime wanted to open up and said, well, we're not going to have Victoria's Secret here, but we'll take the good aspects of your culture. That makes very good sense. You know, there's a huge cultural war going on that the United States is waging against the Western African nations like Nigeria, Ghana, Uganda, Cameroon, and the Gambia. These nations are very traditionally based nations in their cultures. Now, let me tell you something. I lived for a year in Brazil, and I also lived for 1 year in Venezuela under the regime of Chavez. So, and I speak fluent Spanish, so I'm not just someone who's never been, you know, outside the United States. And the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton just gave stinging, rebuking speeches demanding that all these African nations in Jamaica all accept homosexuality in their culture. And it's not going to happen. And it's being viewed as colonialism. And I don't understand why these people who run this country think they have the right to impose these things in Africa and in the Caribbean and in nations that just don't want it. This makes this country look like the old British colonials in their slave ships from hundreds of years ago.
It seems also to contrast, and Marshawn, you commented on this, with China.
Rick, we thank you very much for the call.
Thanks for calling, Rick. This excellent comments. Marshawn, that China doesn't seem to have that same attitude as it extends its influence. They don't seem to want to make little Chinas out of the other countries.
No, but because the Chinese attitude towards empire has always been different, though. In our sense, what, and I think the caller made a very good point, to, in a sense, the Brits wanted to create a little Britain. We don't necessarily want to create little Americas, but what we do want is we'd want to take away their national identity, anything that would unify them to resist.
Right.
So whether it's their belief in Islam, which says that their country forbids homosexual marriage, you know, or forbids the purchase of alcohol, or the fact that the Venezuelans say they want a centralized socialist-based government, you know, it's part of we want to take away their sense of national self, their sense of national identity, so in this way they can never organize to resist, which is, again, an old colonial tactic.
Well, you know, the tactic of people like Hillary Clinton, as the caller pointed out, is the same abroad as it is at home. It's to destroy the central cultural unit, which is the family, essentially,
right.
And is to drive parents away from their children and put a wedge between parents so that there is no community, there's no neighborhood, there's nothing that brings people together. And I mean, here in the United States, what is the biggest stronghold? It's I think the faith. So it's the places of worship. So it's mosques and churches and synagogues and such. So we have a massive effort to infiltrate things like mosques, to drive them away and cause the people to be suspicious of each other's activity and to hold back their free speech.
I think that's a really interesting point, Gus, that the industrial state sees you and me as disconnected individuals who really need the central authority to tell us what to do, when in reality we're all members of a myriad of different groups. Could it be our family, mm-hmm. our neighborhood, our church group, whatever, many different organizations.
But we're taught to trust our disconnected relationships on the internet, like using Facebook and Twitter, which are meaningless exchanges between people. They're only skin deep. But we're taught to trust that more than our family. We're told not to trust our old-fashioned parents, but that we're supposed to get our honor system and our sense of morality from the media, the television, and the internet, so that we have no moral compass and there's nothing keeping us together in times of trouble.
Which is why, I mean, one of the things that I found fascinating is I lived in Egypt for a while, and, you know, Egypt being a third world country, one of the things that amazed me was that if somebody was having a problem or somebody was sick or, mm-hmm. you know, you had an elderly person who couldn't go out and do something for themselves, they didn't rely on the government to come in and take care of it, but the community, the neighbors. I mean, one of my favorite memories from when I was there was an old man on the street who got really sick. I mean, just this man was in a very bad way. And a group of young teenagers saw he was in trouble, and the first thing they did is they ran over, they grabbed him, they helped him, they called a cab, and the cab took him right to the hospital. And, you know, in America, we're so disconnected from each other. But that's the idea, though.
No. Here in America, I've seen articles about ambulance drivers who are on coffee break, and they see someone suffering a heart attack, and they tell them to call 911 because they're on break. You know, that's the kind of stuff that happens here.
But that's and the reason for that is because if you keep people disconnected, like as you saw during the Arab Spring, and I knew people who were living in Egypt during the revolution, the neighbors got together, the police went off the streets because they thought, oh, if we go off the streets, then suddenly, you know, chaos will ensue and then they'll call for the return of the government. Well, that didn't happen. People formed neighborhood watches. And you contrast this with New Orleans just being an example of an American disaster. Everybody in Egypt, in Helwan, in Cairo, in Alexandria, they got on the streets and they, you know, with knives and baseball bats, and they said, you know, we're protecting our communities.
Mm-hmm.
But when people are so disconnected, that's because the people trust each other. They're related by blood. They're related by culture, religion. Whereas when we're all disconnected from each other, we'll never do that. When there's a catastrophe, we hide.
And of course, playing on fear is a key element.
Yeah.
In
disconnection. Well, like what happened in London last summer with the fires that were going on there, right?
Exactly.
The people were going out and forming neighborhood watches, and just by the mere act of a group of people standing at the end of their street protecting their own neighborhood,
yeah.
The London police were coming by and arresting them and telling them to go home because they weren't allowed to practice vigilante justice, when all they were doing was just standing watch and protecting their own homes. So the central authority figures want you to be cowering in fear at home with the lights off, hiding under your bed like we're all in a school lockdown. You're supposed to get out there and show some courage, protect yourself and your neighbors, and stand up for the people who need protection. But the central figures, this new world order, what they want is they want all of us to be cowering and afraid and accusing each other of wrongdoing and calling them to come and protect us, when really what happens, like in the communist situation, they show up in the middle of the night, they screech to a halt, they run in, they kick the door down, and they arrest someone under cover of night, so that it's a chilling effect throughout the whole neighborhood. That's the system we're asking for, and that's what's being set up.
And if we do nothing about it, if we as the American people, while we still have some semblance of a democracy, if we choose to turn on each other, this whole 99 versus the 1%, if instead we, if we don't come together, if we don't stand together as a unified citizenry, because that's what we are. We are citizens of a republic. We aren't just Joe Schmo, Bob and Jane Doe. We are citizens. And that's, we should address each other as that. Like the Romans or the French did in the Republic was, we are citizens. We are participants in this government. And if we do nothing, if we do nothing, we almost mandate what is done to us. And there was a very famous quote from Joseph Goebbels as he was in the bunker during the last days of World War II with Hitler. And General Munk, who was put in charge of the defense of the government district, said to Goebbels, listen, get your militiamen off the street. They were called the Volkssturm. They were old men and young boys who were given guns and sent into battle. And Munk, who was an SS general, said, look, take your Volkssturm off the street. They're getting slaughtered. They're getting massacred. And Goebbels said, I don't care. He said, I don't care. He said, do you think we just did this to the German people? No, they gave us a mandate. And yes, now they're having their little throats cut.
As the listeners can tell, we're not shy about sharing our opinions on American government's policy, and we'd like to hear your views. So give us a ring here at WPKN.
I've been censoring myself.
WPKN. You're listening to In Context on WPKN, our station's live public affairs call-in show. And you can reach us by calling 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Well, we'll be with you for another 15 minutes, so you have that time to get on the air and tell us what you think about the global wars, about American foreign policy, about generally about how we can rediscover and get control over our own government policy. And that's really the theme of this show. We're in context, Gus and Marchand and I, we're not left-wingers, we're not right-wingers, we're not ideologues of any kind. We simply believe that this country should be governed by you and me and not by a bunch of corporations, a bunch of big shots in Washington, that our government policies ought to represent our true American traditions and not just the short-term corporate profit interest.
Remember, we're only on till 1, so if you want to get an email in, send it to ken@mdrtalk.org. And if you want to call in, and you can call the number 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
You know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I was thinking about 15, 20 minutes ago when we were talking about exporting democracy and such, and what the callers have been pointing out. And, you know, the whole theme of the conversation is that we export terror and suspicion. And that's what we export. We don't export democracy. And our system here was set up to be a minority rights protected republic where the majority could never vote to take the rights from the minority. So that no matter what you believed, what you thought, what you said, you were protected, even if you were loony, crazy, whatever. It doesn't matter because you have the rights to say and do and act however you want inside your own home as long as you don't hurt anybody else. That's what our system is supposed to be, but it's morphed into this popular mandate democracy, which doesn't work. It's BS.
I think the founding fathers had a pretty good idea in setting up this country. It was conceived in the Enlightenment, and they thought there would be competing interests, a very limited government. But what they did not foresee was the rise of the industrial state and the concentration of economic and then political power in the hands of a few corporations, which eclipsed all other groups.
I partially disagree. I think that they did see that as a possibility, and that's why there was the minority rights protection in the Bill of Rights, except that they didn't foresee that the people would willfully give it up.
Yeah. And I think you hit it right on the head there, and I think that's part of the problem, is that we haven't had a military junta come in and just take over the country.
Not yet.
We're giving the government the mandate.
On the other hand, though, the president has become the supreme dictator general who can wage war at will now. You don't even need the declaration of Congress. So maybe we do have a military dictatorship.
But if we wanted to, we still have the power to stop it. But the problem is, we're not. And it's like this looming war that we seem to be having with Russia and China, the fact that we seem to be determined to plunge ourselves into a conflict. We as the American people have the chance right now to stop it.
Yeah, we're like,
we're just choosing not
to. The American people, this engine, this supreme engine of ability and ingenuity, we're like the giant henchman for the 4-foot-tall mobster who just says, go get him, tiny, and we like lurch forward, and we do what a bidding of whatever he tells us to do. But the problem is, at any minute, if we just realize that
we have the power, we
have the intelligence and the ability to self-govern, all we have to do is just turn around and say, no, we're not going to do it anymore. But we continually do the bidding.
Well, of course, we're encouraged by the media, which is why we think it's very important that WPKN exists and why we're very grateful for our listeners who were so generous in our recent fund drive to keep us on the air, yep, making, actually breaking through our goal, because it's independent media. They can give you the information you need to fight this system, which is really leading us to these destructive wars, and it is draining our economy. And we see this with our high unemployment and a declining standard of living. So we really appreciate your support keeping In Context and WPKN on the air.
trying to get another call on the air here.
You're listening
to In Context. If you do call in, make sure that you save your question for the air and don't give it to March when he answers the phone.
Multitasking.
Okay. You're ready?
I believe we have a caller.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Dan from Waterbury. Go ahead with your question, Dan.
Ken and Gus and March.
My comment was that in the West, we sort of look towards might makes right, whereas you take a place like Iran and, you know, the question of whether they're developing a weapon, a nuclear weapon, is up for a debate. And I was thinking, you know, well, they founded their country on a religious basis. I mean, I'm not crazy about it, but I mean,
but that's what they have.
There's a certain morality implied there, mm-hmm, which I think we don't have, and that's why we can't I don't really think that our nation, leaders of our nation, are capable of understanding.
That's a really good point, Dan. We can't project like that.
No, it's very presumptuous to assume that because we think a certain way, another country would just ipso facto love it. You know, it's very
presumptuous. I don't understand what you mean.
I mean that, you know, they have their own basis of morality, and for us to presume that they appreciate our way of thinking is rather presumptuous and rather offensive.
I feel that our way of looking at things is very cut and dried, and very, it's based on I mean, the Constitution, to me, I don't even like to think about it, because to me that doesn't, I think that there's just the possibility that they would have a moral high ground is at least implied by the foundation of their nation.
All right, well, thank you very much
thank
for the call.
Thank you very much for your call, Dan.
Bye.
Thank you very much. And this is John from Huntington. Go ahead, John.
Hi, John.
You're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon.
I need a couple of points.
Okay.
Referencing colonial policies, I think is wrong. You're not seeing the forest for the trees, as it were. This is, divide and conquer is just an overarching principle.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't, when you call it a colonial policy, then people would think, oh, okay, that's...
Did we?
For over there.
I think I might have.
You did.
You shouldn't have.
No, but go ahead, John.
Not that it isn't employed, you know, in colonial territories. I'm not denying that at all, but what I'm trying to say is that we have been systematically tuned to new words, level playing fields, taking out, rather in the fashion of 1984. You reduce your vocabulary, you reduce your thought processes.
Yes,
yes, of course.
And one of the things, I believe, is what drives them at the very top is greed. If they were to recognize greed in the same way you would recognize pedophilia, homicidal maniacs and such like, these people would all be in rubber rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I think very true.
I was a seaman for 30 years. I used to travel overseas and, you know, carry all the fundings, you know, overseas. What can I say? And you would talk to people. They're all educated over there. Over here, you do have the stupidest, most ill-informed people there are. There's no two ways to go around it. You know, for you having three people like you in the room, you got 3,000 that are just complete morons out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just basically that ratio. The only way I think we could do anything, you'd have to change the Constitution, maybe make the presidency every 6 years, completely revamp the election laws where you have to have party signatures. And this thing with money equating speech is fallacious. I mean, only a true... truly stupid people go along with this, and they do go along with it. They may watch a CNN and see a positive thing, but the rest of it is all BS. Even Al Jazeera, which comes out in the morning, they give a lot of news, but still they have their slant.
Mm-hmm.
And Webster Topley, well, I don't think people know enough about him to know who he is. And
But you're aware of him?
I'm pleased that you mentioned him, yes.
Yes.
I don't go along with everything he says, but
no, he's a free thinking mind though, and that's why we quote him.
And you mentioned the Saudis, their involvement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's true. The people that were said to be on the plane were from Saudi Arabia, but once again, still melt at 2,750 degrees.
Absolutely, I have very differing opinions on 9/11, but we're
I don't know who did it, but I don't go along with the way I was told that it was done.
No, of course not, and neither do I. But the point of bringing it up is that even if it happened the way the official story says it happened, our response is still illogical. Do you understand what I'm going with that?
I mean, how does a plane fly into Washington?
Oh, yeah.
No, of course.
We're on the same wavelength on that, John.
Yeah. we all are. But the point is that we're pointing out the hypocrisy even in the official story. The people, the controllers here, the social controllers who want to go to war, they can't even get the fake story that they create accurate enough so that it justifies their response.
And I think one of the problems is the American people don't ask any questions. One day Iran has the bomb and is going to drop it on New York, and then the next day, well, maybe they don't have the bomb, and then one day we hate Gaddafi, and then the next day we hate Assad. And the American people never question it. They never stop to think about it. And whether it's stupidity or just plain apathy, I think that is getting to the central crux of the problem.
Well, there's a very important propaganda aspect involved here, in that we have a 24-hour news cycle, we have petty arguments, and we have so much Hollywood worship and sports obsession that it prevents people from ever thinking critically about really important news stories.
Well,
so that
bombarded.
They are bombarded so that they can't discern the difference between what's important and what's completely fake. And we're constantly struggling to try to make ends meet. We don't have the capacity to think about important social societal issues anymore, because we're surrounded by divorce, and we're surrounded by children with disabilities, and everyone is just trying to make ends meet and deal with their own personal problems, that nobody has any capacity left to deal with the world.
Grace, though, fellows.
What's that?
It may not be much of one. You know, maybe the last thing to come out of Pandora's box.
Mm-hmm.
But the people at top, at the very top, are greedy.
Yes.
And they have their spear carriers, their Kissingers and the like.
Yes.
You know, their foundations. But ultimately, their troops, I don't mean the soldiery, but their spear carriers underneath them, are just as stupid as the rest of the population, so you got a chance that way.
Well, of course, yeah. They will recruit the most corrupted individuals among them, the most power hungry.
So you use poor tools and you get poor results, and that's what we have.
That's a good point.
Over.
John, do you see?
I'll hang up and,
Thank you so much for calling,
thank
John.
Thank you very
thanks
much for your call,
again.
John. For receiving my call.
Yeah, of course.
Sure. And we just have a few minutes left on the show. You're listening to In Context on WPKN, a live public affairs call-in show. We're just going to be on the air for another 5 minutes or so. We'd love to hear from you, your opinion, and give it on the air by calling 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. If you give us a call now, we can speak to you before the show ends in about 5 minutes. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Cantavero and our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. We're bringing you our monthly wrap-up analysis of the global wars. We call it the War Report.
And we also do this weekly on YouTube as well.
That's right, we do. We have a weekly In Context Liberty News and War Report episode, two different episodes that we do weekly. And we're trying to build that up and get listener responses and so forth. Ask us questions, post comments. Please subscribe to the channels, In Context Report.
So if you go to YouTube, what do you put in the search engine to find us?
You type into the search, you just type In Context Report and then space channel. And that will bring up our channel at the top of the list. You just click subscribe there, and you can find all of our reports. And, you know, we do with a very interactive show where we show the graphs, we show the articles on the screen so that you can see where we get our sources from. You know, it's all one take, so surprises happen sometimes. But surprisingly very accurate for one take show. We almost never make a mistake, just like here on the air.
Occasionally you get the cat on, or I turn on my mic kind of thing, like I did just now. But this is Jeff from West Hampton. Go ahead, Jeff, you're on
Hi,
the
Jeff.
Air.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, great show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You were speaking before about California and how the military was flying in or involved in drug shipments from South America,
mm-hmm.
Central America.
Yes.
Gary Webb from the San Jose Mercury broke that story.
Yep, he sure did.
Right, that's very important, Gary Webb.
He was found with two bullets in the back of his head that was said it was suicide.
Yep.
10 years after he broke the story, And I want to tell you a very quick story. I was in Arizona and Phoenix in 1983, and a good friend of mine, an Annapolis graduate, full bird colonel, flew in, and he wanted to have dinner with me. And he flew C-130s before he was killed. And
that was the choice plane that they used to bring in the drugs.
Well,
the
C-130. He told me that he was flying in Green Berets and CIAs into El Salvador,
mm-hmm.
and before he would take off from the airport around Washington that all the military fly out of, Andrews Air Force Base, his load manifests would be ripped up by a full bird colonel from the NSA, and
wow.
there would be no record of his flight to El Salvador.
Nice.
He would fly down there, bring in, he said he brought in over 900 Green Berets and military himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the official line at the time, that there were only 900 advisors down there.
Right, advisors.
And then he would have his plane taken away from him. It would be loaded with cocaine,
mm-hmm.
Which he wasn't supposed to know about, but he would take it back to the United States an airport. And he'd be met by another full bird colonel from the NSA who uh-huh. would relieve him of his plane. He'd get the plane back the next day completely clean, and he would fly it away.
What an insight.
He wanted me to know this in case his plane was... He was a Vietnam veteran, full, a lot of medals, great guy. He wanted me to tell his parents what happened to him because he wasn't allowed by law to say anything to anybody.
And what happened to him? Did he?
He died a couple of years ago under mysterious circumstances.
My goodness.
How mysterious?
They just found him dead.
Okay.
And so this really corroborates his firsthand his account of what Gary Webb was writing about in San Jose Mercury about our using drug profits, the CIA using drug profits to finance the covert, the illegal war in Central America.
This is 1983 when he was telling me this story, and it was unrelated to anything I knew about at the time.
Yeah,
it's really amazing.
So this must have completely shocked you. I mean, what was your response to this? Was our government couldn't possibly do this, or what?
Oh no. I realize that our government's been doing this kind of nefarious stuff for a long time,
uh-huh.
but this was outrageous.
Right.
Well, this is a democracy that we're supposed to be spreading.
And we're growing the opium in Afghanistan, and our soldiers are guarding the fields. And, you know, we just put it on Fox News and say, well, we got to do it, otherwise the terrorists get the money.
The drug business and the CIA goes certainly back to the 50s and Operation Paper in Southeast Asia. I mean, it's to day one. Well, thank you so much for calling.
Yes, thank you
very
much.
I really appreciate that.
And I think you got the last call in.
Yeah, last word.
Oh, that's very nice. That was nice to have so many wonderful callers today.
Let's sign off. Make sure you visit our website at incontextreport.com. Find us on Facebook. Just search In Context. And
we'll be on next on March 12th with Dr. Peter Bregan talking about psychiatric drugs. Are they doing more harm than good?
That's right. And visit us on YouTube and search out In Context Report. That's our channel. Okay, everybody?
Incontextreport.com. Take it easy, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Remember, you're citizens.